Let's take a moment to close our eyes. So please close your eyes and go inside of yourself. Let yourself have a good full breath of air. Be aware of the agendas that are going on in you, in your mind, in your body. And as you exhale, let go of those tensions, those agendas. Maybe the hurrying to get here, maybe concerned about something else going on. Give yourself permission to let go of those things so that you can be here. Okay, and now let yourself enter the room slowly by slowly opening your eyes. Begin to let the impressions in. And know that you can be fully present. I'm Dale Jamtgaard, and I see some new faces, and it would be fun to have time to find out who all of you are, but there won't be that time, so I will enjoy talking with you individually as we meet each other around the village. If you have anything that you'd like to share with me, I'd like to hear it. A little about where I'm coming from. I am trained as a social worker and also as a pastor. I worked with Lutheran Family Service of Oregon for 14 years as the director of life education, and previous to that I was a pastor in a parish. And the issue for me has always been, how do we relate our Christian faith to the challenges of everyday living? And how do we help each other grow in this and have a deeper sense of the way in which God would work in us and through us to bear the fruits of life, both in us, as he talks about life abundant, and between us, as he talks about loving one another. And so it's with excitement that I continue to explore all the possibilities implied by that kind of question. And I have explored both in terms of my theological training and understanding, looking into the scriptures, but also by looking at the new discoveries in psychology, physiology, biology, and seeing in all of those things the hand of God. One helps me understand the other. I learn something in psychology and I go into the scriptures, and all of a sudden I see things there that I hadn't seen before. And I come to a deeper understanding spiritually, and I go out and look again at life and look at the psychology or the approaches of life. I see my counseling in new ways. So one informs the other. And all are parts of the gifts of God. So I'd like to share with you today some of the things that have been coming to me around the whole area of how do we deal with stress or the challenges of everyday life. We have started on Monday with a series. The first day we took a look at the overall challenge that I see, and I see it not only then in helping individuals deal with stress, but I sense that what we're looking at is another way of living life in the world. That the issue is finally not how do I just deal with stress, but if I don't deal with stress differently, if nation doesn't deal with nation differently, then we know now that we're on a timetable, that there is an ultimate conclusion, and that is if we continue to deal with problems in the way in which we have in the past, that we're going to blow each other off the earth. So how we have dealt with life is called into question. And that's the global picture, and yet there's also this very important individual picture. And we want to look at the relation between the two. Well, first day we look briefly then at what are stressful in our life. What are the kinds of things? And recognize that stress is experienced very differently. Each person experiences different things as stressful to them. And so it's useful to be aware of what is stressful for you. The second day, we took a look at stresses and how you look at it. That far more than we realize, it's the way in which we look at a situation that determines how stressful it'll be for us. And that when we're experiencing stress, then look at the outer situation, become aware of it, and then tune in and say, how is it that I'm looking at this that is helping to create the stress? What is it I believe about life that is making this so stressful for me? Because we can change the way we look at life. We can change the filters through which we look at life. Today, then, we're going to deal with that response to stress. The mental, physical response to the stressful situations in life. And tomorrow we're going to talk about some of the ways of dealing with the potential ongoing consequences of how we react to stress. Now, one of the filters that we have in our life today is so common for us that we're really not fully aware of how it influences most of what we do. And it affects each of us differently. But understanding it may be illustrated by this little experiment that was done. Would you be willing to... I don't need you yet. I'll need some help later. The exercise was this. The researchers took two groups of boys. They were 9-year-old boys, some from the United States and some from Mexico. And they set up an experiment where they had a long rope with a knot in it. And they drew a line on the floor. And then they brought the boys from the United States in and put one on each end of the rope and gave them the instructions. And they said, every time you can get that knot to pass over that line, you get a dime. And so they said, on your marks, get set, ready, go. And they gave it all they had. They just pulled for all they were worth. They just, you know, good old U.S. spirit, they gave it all they had. And they pulled, and that knot kind of went one way and then back the other. And both of them pulling as hard as they could, and finally getting tired, and finally one pulled the other one over. And they said, okay, let's see, that was 6 times over the line, that's 60 cents for each of you. They called the Mexican boys in. Same instructions, a boy at each end of the line. Every time you get that knot to pass over the line, you get a dime. On your marks, get set, go. Here's $5. What was different between the two?
Mathematics.
What's that?
Mathematics.
Perception of competition. That they immediately saw the situation as competitive and that there had to be a winner and a loser, and they weren't going to be the loser. Whereas the Mexican boys saw it as a cooperative venture. They heard in it the possibility for cooperation. And so they approached the whole problem differently. Now, this may work with boys. It's happened also with a couple of businessmen. Gave them each an end of a dollar bill and drew a little line and said, on your marks, get set, go. And they both pulled just as hard as they could. It's one of the filters with which we look at life, and it shapes the whole way we approach the events in our lives. And can you imagine the kind of stress that it produces? If we believe that always there's going to be a winner and a loser, and I better not be the loser. Now, when someone pushes against you, what do? Push back. Would you come and help me now? Now I need some help. This is a lovely place, but I sure feel like I lose contact with you when I stand up. Yeah. This is the only way I can do it. So if I look like a bobber. Okay, now, begin to push on me. And push some more. Okay, push some more. Push really hard. Okay. Now, describe what you see happening.
You're backing up.
Okay. I'm going to get braced. Okay, what else do you see? What's that?
He's out of balance.
He's out of balance? I'm pretty off balance too, aren't I?
He's in charge.
What would happen if he walked away from me?
Fall.
I'd fall flat in my face, you know. Okay, and what else do you see happening?
I think you're both using all your energy to stay in the same place.
Yeah, and when I push harder, what does he do?
He pushes harder.
And then I have to do what? And then he has to. Yeah. Okay. And what happens when we both keep pushing? We don't get anywhere. We keep focused on each other until the point that one of us gets tired, exhausted, and gives up. We become, what happens to our perception? It's very locked in. Boy, I'm not going to let him get past me. Now, this is often in the way we approach threats or demands or stressful situations, is that we tend to focus rather narrowly. We begin to push hard. And the harder we push, the more resistance we get, and the harder we have to push. And we both become locked in the conflict. Is it very possible at that moment to see any alternatives? Most of my energy is right there. Boy, I'm not looking at alternatives at that point. It's hard to think of them, or hard to have enough energy to look at anything else. I'm just hoping that I'm going to last long enough to win. Okay, now that is often the way we approach threats. And that becomes the kind of fight-flight response to stress, where we gear up, we focus rather narrowly, and we strain to win in some way. Now, the alternative would be a flight response, which would have been to just walk away from it. And, in a sense, to have lost the issue. So either fight or flight seems to be our alternative. And we often get stuck between those two alternatives. Now let's take a look at what happens in us when we get locked in that kind of a fight-flight position. And now I'd like to take a look at some of the psychophysiology. What goes on in our mind, what goes on in our body, and what can we begin to understand about that? A little historical perspective. Prior to 1950, the view of how we functioned was that essentially we had the cortex, which did our thinking, and we had the subcortex, which handled the bodily functions. That the two function somewhat independently. And that's the way we approached the mind-body. It was difficult for us to understand any real interaction between the two because we thought they were two separate entities. And because of that then, we didn't have much of a way of understanding how the mind could affect the body or the body affect the mind. Then we've developed a more unitive system or way of understanding. What we discovered was it's called the reticular system. It's the connecting channels of neurons between the cortex, the thinking part of our brain, and the subcortex. And the reticular system then is a two-way system that alerts the cortex and translates the cortex messages into impulses to the body. This system then helps us begin to understand a little how we react with stress. Because stress usually comes first as a perception and comes into our mind. We interpret a situation, we see it and then we perceive it, we interpret it, and we have a thought about it. And that happens in the moment, and that impulse then is transmitted from the cortex down to our subcortex. And We've discovered the role of what is called the hypothalamus, which is a little gland right in the middle of our brain, about the size of a cherry. And the hypothalamus has become a key to understanding the stress reaction. And what that does is it triggers our autonomic nervous system and our endocrinological system. The autonomic nervous system, now we have both the nervous system that is our voluntary nervous system, where we control our voluntary movements. We have a thought, we decide to move our arm, and we do that. And then the involuntary, or the autonomic nervous system, which is the system that handles the more automatic responses of our body, the ongoing, the control of our heartbeat and breathing rate and so forth. A lot of things that we don't do consciously are controlled by the autonomic system. The autonomic nervous system has two parts to it. One is the sympathetic system and the parasympathetic. And these then become important to understand. The sympathetic is the part of our system that gears us up when there's a stressful event. It mobilizes us, gets us ready for the fight response. The parasympathetic system is the part that helps us gear down, relax, slow down, open up. And we know more about how to gear up in life, and this is more emphasized as we grow up as kids and in our society. You know, gear up, get going, tackle it, hit the job. We haven't done much to train our parasympathetic system. Take it easy, slow down, relax, open up. You know, how many times as parents did you say that to your kids? I know I am aware myself that I was more often wanting to push, get going, do this, do that, you know, gear up. And seldom did I give attention to the importance of, hey, take it easy. And so that's a cultural emphasis that I think is creating part of our problem. And we'll look more at that as to what it means to know how to gear down. Then the endocrine system, what happens is the hypothalamus sends a hormone over to the pituitary gland, and the pituitary gland triggers the thyroid gland and the adrenal glands and sends adrenaline and cortisone throughout your system, and your muscles begin to gear up. A number of things happen. Your pupils dilate and open. Your hearing becomes sharper. You're more tense in your throat, your shoulders, your upper back. There's more kind of a raising of the shoulders, a gearing up. The blood in your system comes from your hands and your feet into the central system. It goes to your brain and to your heart, the key support systems. In other words, those that are most critical to your survival get the focus of the blood coming in. That's why often we talk about cold hands and cold feet when we're faced with a stressful situation. The stomach the stomach begins to relax. The genitals are deadened, and the anus is kind of tightened, gearing up to kind of hold us together, not deal with other kinds of functions, shut down all other functions, and just have the functions that deal with gearing up our muscles so that we're ready to go. Our respiratory system increases to pump the oxygen into the blood, and we are geared up, ready to fight or to flight. Now, a characteristic of that was significant in its understanding is that the sympathetic system is non-specific, which means that when there is a threat, you gear up your body in a whole general way. In other words, you would have the same, if someone called you a name or if someone pulled a gun on you, you would have the same gearing up of your whole body. In other words, it doesn't just gear up the part of you that you may need. In other words, if someone called you a name, all you'd need to do maybe is to have your mind in gear to think about what you wanted to do and something you wanted to say. Whereas if someone's coming at you with a club, you may want to gear up your whole physical system. Well, the mind doesn't differentiate between those two. It does the same thing, no matter what the threat is. There does seem, however, to be some differentiation in terms of the kind of adrenaline that gets into the blood. Adrenaline itself seems to gear us up in terms of tightening our breathing, shallow breathing, and accelerated heart, and dilating the heart and the muscle arteries so that the blood flows through us fast. And that tends to be related to fear. Now, if you know, your fear reaction is kind of a kind of reaction. The tightening of the breathing and the opening up of the blood flowing through us. Noradrenaline seems more related to an anger reaction. And an anger reaction is a tightening of the arterial system, the arteries, and an increasing of the blood pressure. So we tighten up more with anger. We go, pull back with fear. And so that's one differentiation that we've been able to discover as we look at our whole functioning. Now, when we face a threatening situation, our whole system gears up, ready to deal with it physically, essentially, mentally and physically. There's a problem with that, and that is that we have basically a fight or a flight response. Now notice what happens. We gear up to deal with the problem physically. The boss comes in and says, "Can't you ever get anything right? This is, you know, really bad." And you go like that. You'd like to hit him. But what would happen? You'd lose your job. You know, you'd really be in trouble. He might beat you up too. So the physical response doesn't fit. Now think of all the ways that you react with this ready-to-go kind of reaction when you can't express it physically. And this then is a major dilemma for us in this day, is that the fight-flight response seems to have been geared for us to meet the physical threats of the past. Now it's only been in the past 100 years since we've begun to develop our technology that we have essentially begun to rule out the actual force, use of force in our everyday life as a way of solving problems. Prior to that, the use of physical force was a very common way of dealing with everyday issues. And so, in a sense, we're all geared up with no place to go. We feel like fighting or we feel like running. And so if you run, say the boss says that to you and you run out the door, again, where are you? It doesn't fit. What I sense has happened then is we get all geared up. Sometimes we go home and kick the dog. In other words, we get rid of it one way or another. But oftentimes we don't get rid of that fight energy and we begin to store it up in us. And we have to hold it. So we not only have the fight response, but then we have all the energy that goes into trying to hold it in. And there's a fight inside of us. In a sense, the fight has moved from outside to inside of us, and we begin to tear ourselves up and eat ourselves up with this kind of attention going on inside of us. Now, the first day I mentioned that we are having the four afflictions of the more civilized modern world are cardiovascular diseases, heart attacks and strokes, respiratory diseases, cancer and arthritis. Now, could these then be the result of this kind of a dynamic where we have only a fight-flight response that doesn't fit, and finally it moves inside of us, and we're beginning to wear ourselves out inside in ways that we haven't done in other cultures, less technological cultures. If that's true, that means then that we must begin to develop some kind of an alternative. Because if we go on, the pace of change, the technological development, is accelerating. And if we continue to try to react to it the way we have, then we're going to continue to do things to ourselves. Now, one of our answers to that, of course, has been then to try to tranquilize ourselves with alcohol, with drugs, medication, various kinds of things. How do we deaden that action and that pain so that we don't have to deal with it? And that's one alternative. However, my concern would be there's a high price to pay for it. And we'll look at that. We need an alternative. Let's turn to what Jesus might have to say. He says, "You have heard that it was said, an eye for an eye, and a tooth for a tooth. But I say to you, do not resist one who is evil. But if anyone strikes you on the right cheek, turn to him the other also. And if anyone would sue you and take your coat, let him have your cloak as well." And get this. If anyone forces you to go 1 mile, go with him too. Give to him who begs from you, and do not refuse him who would borrow from you. What's been your reaction as you've heard those words? Jesus, you know, you're a pretty smart guy, but not very practical. I think this often has been our response. That just does not compute in our world of competitiveness. And the feeling is we would get run over so fast if we tried to live with those kinds of principles that life wouldn't be worth living. It just doesn't fit. And it doesn't fit because I think of our filters, our perception that life is essentially competitive. And that's the only way that really works. Now, how could these then be seen as an alternative? I'd like to suggest that there is an alternative, and I think we're going to need to open up to it, because it may not fit a lot of the way we think and a lot of the way we function right now. But there's some things that are coming that are beginning to say it is possible and that we can move in those directions. The alternative is... I use the word blend here, but my wife came up with a term I like, fight, flight, or flex, as an alternative. Fight, flight, or flex. The characteristics of this fight, flight, or blend, or flex I'm using at this point, are three. One is to be able to be in a relaxed, alert position. Relaxed alertness. And we're going to look more at what that is about. That is something we don't know much about how to do. We're either relaxed or alert, but putting the two together is often, we're not really aware of how to do that. Having an open perception. Being able to open up and take in what's going on around us. In many ways, we have very limited awareness of what's going on in us and around us. And we'll take a look at a little of why that is. And then blending the stressors or the demands from outside of us with our own goals. I call it intentional blending. How does so relate to others that are placing the demands on us in such a way that we can move with them to to an ultimate common goal. Now, we could just say that would sure be nice. It'd be nice if we could do what Jesus said, but we doubt that we could do that. After all, given human nature and the way we are, it doesn't seem that it would work. And so I believe that God is continuing his revelations, and they're found in some various kinds of discoveries. And let me point to some discoveries that are happening that I think make this begin to seem more possible to us. The first one that I want to point to is what's happening in terms of discovering the brain. Only recently have we really focused our research and our understanding on the brain. And what we're discovering is mind-boggling. Your brain is about 3 pounds. It's about 2% of your body weight. It utilizes 20% of your body energy. That little 3 pounds has 100 billion cells. 100 billion cells in it. 80% or 80 billion of those cells are the glial cells. And they're the cells that hold things together. The other 20% or 20 billion cells are neurons that provide you with your consciousness. Now, 20 billion is a big number. But listen to how it goes from here on. Each of those neurons has 20 million molecules of RNA. And RNA can convert DNA genetic interactions to 100,000 different proteins. So each cell, 20 million and 100,000 possibilities within each one of the 20 million RNAs. And each neuron with the 20 million in it can link up with 1,000 other neurons. So there is the possibility of 10 to the 800th power connections in your brain. Now that's a number that is probably not comprehensible because they estimate, I don't know how they arrived at this, but they estimate that 10 to the 800th power is more atoms than there are in the universe. That's the number of potential connections within a brain. And so that little 3 pounds is a fantastically complicated, magnificent creation. Every second, that brain is taking in 7 billion bits of information. And you're barely conscious of a millionth of those. So there's a lot going on that you're not aware of. And that brain is storing all kinds of things. Now we're discovering some things about knowing. We have thought, essentially, of the brain as one unit, and that our knowing or thinking took place in that one unit. What we're discovering is that the brain has two parts, the right and the left brain, and that they function differently. The right brain controls your left side, and your left brain controls your right side. Your right brain tends to think in holistic pictures. It tends to think more in the bigger systems. The right brain would be, for instance, where you would hold music. You would hold pictures of things, your imagination, these kinds of things. The left brain is more focused and logical. It's where your language is, specific meaning of words. So that oftentimes people, for instance, if their left brain is damaged, they lose their ability to speak words. But they might be able to sing the words because their right brain has the words connected with the music. And sometimes then they can retrain the brain to speak through the words connected with music. So there's a lot of things that are being discovered. Now, we've often thought of this, you know, as the right brain is more intuitive and the left brain more logical. And we've tended to attribute those characteristics to men and women. Men are logical and women are intuitive. But what we're discovering is we all have those capacities in us, and that for some reason there's been at least a tendency for women to develop more of the intuitive, maybe because of their roles and so forth, and men more of the logical, the more focused approach. What we're discovering, and what business and other groups are discovering, is that to fully be, to use our full capacity and be fully creative, we need to use both parts of us. And so there are training programs in learning how to use the intuitive as well as the logical and recognize the value of both. So as we come together, that's part of, I would imagine, what's happening as women come into the workforce, bringing often more of the intuitive sense of things, and men contributing more of the logical, and not implying that either one doesn't have the other, but discovering how to develop both within ourselves. Well, now there's that is raising all kinds of implications for education, how to educate people, how to think, how to deal with life. If we're stuck in only one mode and aren't using the other part of our brain, we're missing part of our capacity. So that's been quite revolutionary in and of itself. And now we're discovering that there is a third way of knowing, and that is that we've tended to think in terms of the five senses. But we're finding that the body has senses, that there are 26 to 30 what are called proprioceptive sensors in our muscles. And that you may have noticed that you just have a sense of things at times. Your body kind of tells you what's going to happen or tells you what's going on. You just feel it. And you may not have even seen it as something separate. But there's a sense now in which we're beginning to recognize that to be functioning as fully as possible, that we can do this with a balance of the right brain, the left brain, and our body sensing. Those three ways of knowing and intuiting things. In addition, we're recognizing that the brain has different wavelengths. The beta waves are the faster waves that you're using most of the time when you're thinking. Alpha waves are a little slower waves that you have right before you go to sleep or when you're very relaxed. And then theta waves and delta waves are the brain waves that you have during sleep. What we're finding is that when you want to learn something, that if you're in your alpha brainwave state, you're much more likely to record it and remember it. That when your mind is very busy in the beta wave state, that often it doesn't record as much and as deeply. So this is where you're hearing about sleep learning and playing tapes or saying things before you go to bed or when you get up in the morning. That's the time if you want to program something into your mind, if you want to think about something that will stay with you, to do it at those times and program the way you think. So these are some of the discoveries that we're making that I think is going to make it possible to come at things a little differently. What's a body? Well, the Greeks thought that the mind and the spirit, that's where it was at. And the body, well, we're kind of trapped in our body. The body's the lower level of us. It's what we have to put up with. It's the source of our real problems. It's the source of our temptations. You know, and if we could rise above this body, then we'd have it made. And so with that dualistic background in the Greek thinking, in many ways the body was kind of negated or seen as a secondary kind of thing. Then we came along to more of a scientific approach. We began to look at body as substance. Much earlier we thought in terms of flesh and blood and bone and and muscle. And then with our scientific approach, we began to look carefully at those and analyze and study how this machine worked. And we tended to think of the body as a machine. It's a mechanical thing that needs to be understood, and we're going to go in and analyze how it functions and how it works. And we saw it then as something that would be attacked by germs and made to malfunction by things coming at it from the outside. And so disease and illness, and that was a major breakthrough, discovering that it wasn't just demons that was making the body malfunction, but that there were some germs and some problems. However, we've gone on to realize that it's not just germs, but there are many other things that cause the breakdown within the body. But what then is the body? Again, some of the dichotomy, the dualistic thinking, has tended to make us think that we have to push our body, that we have to make our body do things. And so we spend millions of dollars, at least, on backaches, because we push and strain ourselves by thinking that our body is something separate from us and we have to make it do the things we need in life.
But what is our body? Well, we've come to realize it's a chemical system. We're understanding more of the hormones and all of the implications of that. We're beginning to understand it as an electrical system. That when your brain has an impulse, it's an electrical impulse in some way. And we're understanding the neurological functioning electrically. We begin to see that there's an electrical field. So that we have, you know, to some extent, an electrical field about it. We have an olfactory field. You have an olfactory body. You have odor so far out. We don't think much about that in this country, except trying to do away with our body odor. But in some cultures, they're very aware of it. And for them, getting to know a person is to be close enough to smell their odor. So they don't talk this far away. They get close so they can smell each other. Well, we also have a vapor body, that our body is constantly putting off a stream of vapor as we perspire. And so that body's around us. We have a magnetic body. Our body is a magnetic system, and that can be tested and checked out. These are the kinds of bodies that can be checked out. We also have what might be called a telepathic body. This one we haven't figured out how to measure. And we hear all kinds of stories about things that seem to be only explainable by a telepathy from one mind to another. And yet we haven't found out how to measure that. And because we haven't, there's still a lot of skepticism about it. But how big is your body? You know, telepathy sometimes goes hundreds of miles. Maybe you have a telepathic body that's out here. And then we seem to have an energy body or a light body. And again, we haven't been able to measure this. We're only getting clues of it, except it's a very old image. If you look at art in a good number of cultures, they depict their saints with auras. Now, how is that a common expression in different cultures? And there are people who definitely feel they can see auras and can get some clue of what's going on with a person by what they see. Now, I haven't yet found I'm able to see this, but I'd sure like to. One story a fellow was telling, he was talking about auras to a group in a home, and a daughter arrived home from school, and she listened for a little bit, and she said, "Well, I can see auras. I can see those colors." And, you know, "You can?" "Yeah." She said, In fact, I watched the teacher," she said, "and when I see her color change, I know something's going to happen." And so he said, "Well, okay, take a look at this man here and tell me what you see." And she began describing the light around him. She said, "There's a gray around his shoulder. It's like there's something maybe wrong there." And this man had not told anyone in that room, but he was going in for surgery for a tumor in his shoulder. And she was right on in terms of picking up something. And there are people who claim that they can do this in terms of seeing what's going on in the body by checking out the aura. Now these things are stretching us in terms of how to see the body. And so when I get stretched, sometimes I go back and take a look. Here's Jesus. So the eye is the lamp of the body. So if your eye is sound, your whole body will be full of light. But if your eye is not sound, your whole body will be full of darkness. If then the light in you is darkness, how great is the darkness? And then in other places, he says, you are the light of the world. Walk in light, as Jesus is in the light. Now maybe then, our body is basically and ultimately a system of energy, a system of light energy, that may extend quite a ways out from where we are. So where is our body? What is our body? We can begin to see it in different ways. And as a result, we can begin to see the possibilities of a mind-body interaction that did not make sense when we saw the body as essentially as a machine. If the body is a machine and has a mind on it, we don't see how the two affect each other. We don't see how the electrical impulse in the brain may shape the whole body. But if we see it as energy, then we can begin to understand how a little flick of thought, electrical impulse, can shape the whole energy of the body. Like a garage door opener. A little flick of energy and the whole door moves. As a man thinketh, so is he. Is there a way in which we shape our whole body and finally all of reality by how we think? We begin then to have a framework, a way of looking at things that helps us to begin to see the dynamic interaction. There was a group of students over in Japan that were used to do an experiment. One third of them were touched with a leaf and just told it was a leaf. Another third of them were touched with a leaf and told it was poison oak. Another third of them were hypnotized and touched with a leaf and told it was poison oak. The first third had no symptoms. The second and third group had a significant incidence of poison oak symptoms. The leaf was not poison oak, but they thought it was. Now sometimes you notice where you see husband and wife who've been married for 20, 30, 40 years, and they begin to look alike. How does that happen? You ever wondered about that? You think they started out that way? So there's a lot of shaping. Some experiments with Carillion photography, and that's a method that at this point is has a lot of questions about it, but I think has interesting implications. And what the people who do it say is we're photographing something and we're not sure what all it's about. But for instance, they put two people's fingers on a plate and they take a picture, and the picture shows a band of light around each of the fingers. And then they take repeated pictures. Now what happens, they put two people on that and had them begin to have an argument. And one light got a lot brighter and the other light became dimmer. Whosoever hateth his brother is a murderer. Is there a sense in which finally the hate or the thought can affect another person's energy? Is there a reality to it? Or they put a man and woman fingers together who were a couple and they had them kiss. And there was a ball of light appeared in between the two fingers. Now, is it a reality that if we are energy systems, that when two begin to live together and blend their energy, the two become one, in a sense that we haven't just realized before, that there is a new system, that there's a oneness of energy that results in some way? Okay, this just opens us up to then begin to look at what can be the reality of these things in terms of going the second mile. I believe also then, as we begin to understand the dynamic interaction between mind and body, do we not begin to see the dynamic interaction between spirit, mind, and body? If God is the source of life, and if walking in the light, if Jesus is the light, are we not in a dynamic interaction that our very existence is tied to, in a very direct way, the presence of Christ and the power of God? And that prayer then is a way of opening that channel so that the power and light may move in us and through us and empower us to live. All kinds of possibilities. Rather than seeing us as two separate, I am a body, I'm a mind here, God is over there, we're kind of two separate kinds of entities, and yeah, prayer, well, it might have some effect, might do some good, but there's no framework to have a sense of maybe the dynamic that can happen between the two. That ultimately, we aren't just me as a separate entity, but I am only me in relationship to God. That relationship is always there, and I'm either locking it out, not living with it and believing it and trusting in it, or I am open to an actual energizing kind of dynamic that's there. Implications of that, then, for the three dimensions of what it would mean to flex or to go the second mile. The first issue of being relaxed alert. One of the discoveries recently is that the autonomic functions of the body we thought were so automatic that we couldn't affect them with our mind. And we learned from the yogis, we practice yogi a great deal, that they're able to affect their blood pressure, and they're able to affect their heartbeat, that they have far more control over what's going on in themselves than we thought was possible. So we're beginning to discover, I think, that maybe it is possible to separate the two functions of being relaxed and being alert, that we don't have to totally gear ourselves up. Maybe we can learn how to do something different. Now, to experiment with that, and there isn't time to do that right now, experiment with sitting straight, letting yourself be totally relaxed, just letting your whole body drape over your skeleton, letting the thoughts racing through your mind slow down, watch your thinking, and just have a sense of those thoughts slowing down slower and slower and slower. And then have a sense of what it would mean to just be aware. The issue then about whatever happens in neutral, which is my title for today. Or no, that's the one for next time. Deal with that. So it wasn't one for today. But that issue is how to discover how to get into that neutral position. The second issue, well, first, we tend to think that being geared up and focused the way I was pushing is the only way to be strong. And we are discovering, now you're hearing a lot about the inner game of tennis, the inner game of skiing. What they're discovering is two things. One, that as they relax and as they have a mental image of what they want to do, they're able to do it far better. There was an experiment done where they had runners run the 400-yard dash. And on the first day, they told them, run it just as hard as you can. Give it all you've got. Try hard. And they ran it, and they timed them. The second day, they had the runners run the same race, and they said, hey, give it about 80% of your effort. You know, let yourself go, just let yourself run it, kind of enjoy it, but only use about 80% of your effort. And a good number of them ran it faster the second day than they did the first day. That when we gear up and try hard to do something, often we lock up our strength and our energy. When we let go, open up, we are strong. Now, have you seen this little experiment? There isn't time to do it now, but where they put a person who is fairly heavy set in a chair, and they have four people come up, and they put their fingers, two of them put their fingers under their legs and two under the arms, and they say, okay, now see if you can lift. Let's see, this guy is about 250 pounds. See if you can lift this guy. And they go, and they aren't able to lift him often, or only with great strain and effort. And they say, okay, now relax, and we want you to imagine this person being lifted. And we want you to just relax, and we're going to go one, two, three. And when you put your fingers under there, just imagine him going up. Just imagine him floating right up. And they go one, two, three, whoop, and they just stand there in amazement because they're holding him up so high. That we have tremendous power in us. The psalmist talks about it as to run and not be weary. That the reason for a great deal of our fatigue and tiredness is not the lack of strength that we're all worn out, it's what we do to ourselves mentally. You've probably noticed, you come home some night and, oh man, this is it, I'm really pooped, I can't move, I can't do anything. And a good friend of yours calls and says, hey, how'd you like to go bowling? And the friend, you really feel great about having the friend call, and all of a sudden, whoop, there you are, ready to go. And it wasn't a lack of strength or energy that was affecting you. Now, the open perception, when jungle fighters were trained, they were trained not to look for the enemy. Because if they looked for the enemy, they'd miss him. They'd be looking here and something would happen over here. So they trained them to use soft eyes, to open up and to see and to move in a relaxed, alert way. Not like this, but like this. Because then they were ready. Their perception was open to take in what was going on. And the third element then, intentional blending. Intentional blending has some characteristics. One is to have a framework that includes both you and the enemy. Both you and the threat or the demand. Rather than trying to eliminate the other, there needs to be room for both of you. So you need a framework that's big enough that will include you. Now, you see how we haven't come to that in terms of nationality interests yet. We still don't sense ourselves as one world. And we still are drawing circles around we and they, and I don't trust you, and you're different than me, and you know, all kinds of ways we try to eliminate whatever is a threat to us. We need a framework that includes others. We need a framework that puts the threat into perspective. We talked a little about that yesterday, what difference will it make in 5 years and so forth. But we need a framework that sets it in perspective. What really is important, really? Now Jesus finally says, you know, hey, these people can only kill your body. They can't kill your spirit. So even your life, maybe, isn't that big a deal. If what's really important is that you live in the kingdom of God, whether you live now or after death with him. And then the third one is how to have the kind of a goal that makes it possible for both to win. A win-win goal. How to both have a place and get, in some way, one's needs met. And that's what Jesus seems to be saying. That, hey, when you sense your real goal, you're able to go the second mile. If your real goal is to be able to love your neighbor and live with him in the world, and even love your enemy and live with him in the world, if that's your real goal, then what have you got to lose by going the second mile? What have you got to lose by giving him your cloak, if that's your goal? The method then is being able to move with the other person and an example of that, a very practical one, is active listening. Now maybe some of you heard that. Where you try to get with a person, you try to understand them, you try to move with them towards what it is they're concerned with. And it has often tremendous impact on life. Now, the bell's about to ring. back to what I started with last time. Jesus talks about anxiety and all the problems of anxiety, and he ends with, seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all these things will be added unto you. And I see, therefore, the framework as being the kingdom of God, the grace of God, that as I live in his kingdom and sense his power at work in me and through me, that I can face the various threats and I can begin to put them into perspective. And I can maybe even let go enough to see that I can let my cloak go and go the second mile and respond to people, because ultimately it'll be a win-win kind of situation. In that sense, that I think Jesus sees a tremendous possibility, because if we do that, if we begin to open up, we will find tremendous capacities for life. Capacities to know, capacities to do. And Jesus said, greater works than I do will you do. And if you go back and read what he was saying with this kind of a perspective, you will see him urging us to open up to all the possibilities that are present in us and all the potential that we have as human beings to live life fully, and all the capacities for healing, for loving, for being alive. And that's what's exciting to me about being a Christian and seeing the discoveries that God is making to us known now in many different ways, and how that opens up what being a Christian may be about and may be possible for us.